At this point, I would like to introduce our presenter for today. Libby Jeffrey is the Vice President on the Board of Regina's Chapter of Amnesty International Group 91. She joined Amnesty because she seeks the impact of collective action to inspire change. Libby has an undergraduate degree in International Development Studies from the University of Winnipeg and works at the Institut Français at the University of Regina. Having lived in Ireland, Benin, Winnipeg, and Regina, Libby continues to pursue volunteer opportunities that will change her perspective and permit her to see the world from the prairies. Libby.
Thank you very much for having me today. I'm very excited to be here and speak on behalf of our Group 91 of Amnesty. In the description of this talk today, I wrote about a Colombian lawyer who was taken from his home and arrested by security forces. And before getting in the police car, he managed to shout out, "Call Amnesty, call Amnesty," before he was taken away. So what happened next was that others in the house immediately responded and contacted Amnesty International. And members of the Urgent Action Network reacted so quickly that the faxes protesting against the detention of this lawyer made it to the prison before he did. So that's just a little story about collective action and the impact that it can have if we respond quickly. In this picture here, this is the conference that we had in October, October 18th. We have a conference every year with our group, and we had it out in Humboldt this year. So that was a lot of fun. Here's just a few other shots of different campaigning that we do with signs and at different events in Regina. But going back to that story and why I chose that story to share with you, I was looking online for more information about it, because on the website it simply said Colombian lawyer 1989. I was like, well, what's his name? I want to know more about him in the context, right? And I wasn't able to find that information, to be honest. But what I like about that story, and that it is on the website of Amnesty anyway, is that that lawyer could be any one of us. With Amnesty, it's not so much who the lawyer is or what they were doing or things like that that make us act on people's behalf. It's more the fact that they are human beings and they have rights. So what are human rights? Human rights are the rights that you have simply because you are a human. That lawyer, regardless of guilt or innocence, needs a fair trial. Things like that. They need to be detained. They need access to their family. They need to not be put in situations that will permit torture. They need to have access to medical care. And also, what are human rights? It is how you instinctively expect and deserve to be treated as a person. So that's another part that I liked about that story. It says the action that was taken right away. And I think that that reaction that activists have, that supporters have, it really has a lot to do with the word instinctively. People are surprised when rights are taken from them, when they don't expect it, and then all of a sudden they don't have the same access to rights as they did yesterday, or last night, or this morning, you know? So those are just two little things I wanted to highlight with that particular story. To give you an idea of kind of the International Bill of Rights framework, Amnesty International bases a lot of its work on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So that's 30 articles. And the point of that is to be very clear and concise about what basic human rights are. So that was brought into effect December 10th, 1948. And it really, Amnesty International really depends on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all that information in the urgent actions, and it really guides what we do. Also, there's the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and then the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So those ones, those were ratified in 1966, so substantially after the UDHR coming out, and those give more explanation as to what the state needs to do in the context of these rights and what the state's responsibilities really are. Uh, Okay, and so I'm sure that many of you are familiar with Amnesty International, especially with Hillary and Jim in the congregation here. The logo for Amnesty, there's this little candle in the bottom corner of the screen here. So it's a candle with barbed wire around it. So the candle symbolizes hope, and then the barbed wire around it symbolizes prison, those kind of that conflict between the two of them. Amnesty's motto comes from an ancient Chinese proverb: "It is better to light a single candle than to curse the darkness." So that I think that kind of sums up the motivation of a lot of people that are a part of Amnesty. A big part of Amnesty's work is campaigning. It's the world's largest human rights movement, over 3 million members in more than 150 countries. And the campaigning really, it's a bottom-up organization. It really depends on the membership involvement and what people want to see happening. Keeping in mind that these are human rights, so it's up to us to kind of figure out what we're doing next with that. So they do have consultations with the members and supporters of Amnesty to figure out long-term strategic planning. Important to note that Amnesty remains independent of political and partisan interests, so a lot of its funding comes from its members. And how does Amnesty work? So there are a lot of research and missions that Amnesty takes on. This picture is a 2013 mission to Chad, where Alex Neve, who's the Secretary General for Amnesty Canada, is interviewing witnesses of human rights violations. The research teams with Amnesty investigate reports of human rights abuses. They cross-check info from a wide variety of sources and contacts. So that could be prisoners, others suffering from human rights abuses, survivors of abuse, families, lawyers, journalists, refugees, diplomats, religious bodies, community workers, it could be humanitarian organizations, and other human rights organizations and defenders. Amnesty sends around 130 research teams to visit approximately 70 countries every year. The ongoing research and media monitoring, it's of events unfolding around the world. And in its 50-year history, Amnesty's conducted more than 3,300 research missions and published more than 17,000 reports about human rights around the world. So it's really worthwhile to check out the Amnesty website and tap into some of that information. So from the research and missions, then there's publicizing the findings. So this is an Uyghur activist. She was a former prisoner of conscience. Her name is Rabia Kadir. The research leads to reports and the urgent actions. So that's when they send it through the urgent action network. People get emails telling them, like I get maybe about 4 emails a week. I signed up for that list. And it notifies us of when a person is in immediate danger as a result of the violation of a basic human right. So the urgent action is launched. Typically, it tries to prevent a person from being tortured, unlawful arrest, disappearances in detention, denial of medical care, and executions. So from there, there's independent or collective actions. Here's some people from our Group 91. We meet at Atlantis Coffee every week on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock. Just open to the public, whoever wants to come and write some letters and send them off in the mail. And then from there, you get change in awareness. So this is Angel Colon. He was recently released from prison in Mexico. He was released October 17th. He had been arrested, tortured into signing a false statement, which was used to implicate him in criminal activity. So he retracted the statement when brought before a judge and reported his torture to the authorities, who failed to take action. He was in prison for, I believe it was almost 5 years. But what is just really exciting, like in the weeks leading up to when he was freed, there were more than 20,000 messages sent to Mexican authorities on his behalf. So that was just this past October, so that's a really recent good news that we had. And upon leaving prison, the message that he issued to Amnesty was, "My message to all those who are showing me their solidarity and are against torture and discrimination is don't drop your guard. A new horizon is dawning. I feel happy about what is happening." So in terms of Amnesty's work, when it started in 1961 by a lawyer named Peter Benson, it was mostly focused on prisoners of conscience. So that's anyone in prison because of their race, sexual orientation, religion, political views. It could also refer to those who have been imprisoned or persecuted for the nonviolent expression of their conscientiously held beliefs. But since then, the mandate has expanded to include work on changing the lives of individuals, protecting human rights defenders, strengthening the international human rights framework, bringing perpetrators to justice, and influencing legislation and policy. In terms of strengthening the international human rights framework, Amnesty has helped form the International Criminal Court. It's also worked a lot with Indigenous partners to develop and promote the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, and also to push for an effective international arms treaty. That was one of their treaty. So that was one of their campaigns as well. The current campaign is the Stop Torture campaign. So that's what this year's is. And here's a look at all the issues that Amnesty Canada works on. Some of them are more of the focus at one time than another. For example, there's the business and human rights issue. So that would be the Open for Justice campaign with mining in Guatemala. I don't know. I'm sure some of you were here a few weeks ago for Robbie's talk there. So that one might be of interest. For me, I'm interested in the refugees and migrants issues, women's human rights as well. And of course, the first on the list there is the torture campaign. I shouldn't say torture campaign against torture. to be clear. So this is Omar Khadr. Some of you might be familiar with this case. It was around 2002. Yeah, I see some heads nodding. So Omar Khadr was seriously injured and captured by U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 2002. He was 15 years old at the time, and he was a child soldier. He was accused of throwing a grenade that killed a U.S. Special Forces soldier. Months before his capture, the international community determined that child soldiers need to be demobilized and reintegrated into society. In spite of that, the U.S. sent a number of children, including Omar, to Guantanamo Bay. He was 10 years in U.S. custody before finally being transferred to a Canadian prison September 29th, 2012. And to clarify the reason why Canada is involved with Omar, like, he was in Afghanistan at the time, but he is Canadian-born. So normally, normally it would, like, Canada would choose to seek extradition or repatriation. I shouldn't say normally, but it was expected of Canada to do that rather than leave him in Guantanamo Bay as a child soldier. He's believed to be the only child soldier put on trial in modern history, and the last Western citizen to be held in Guantanamo, because Canada had not chosen to seek extradition or repatriation for him. Juvenile justice standards clearly state that children should not be tried before military tribunals. So there are a lot of organizations working on his behalf, including UNICEF and different organizations other than Amnesty. There's the Toronto Coalition to Stop the War. There's many organizations that were interested in this issue. His status as a child combatant, the violations on his charter rights when they continued to interrogate him in Guantanamo, despite the fact that his detention and treatment violated international standards, have not been explained since then. And further, the allegations of torture he experienced and ill treatment are credible and have not been investigated. So this case is definitely not over for Omar. It's still it's a really interesting case. So I recommend that you look it up on our website. And then there's also the Lubicon Cree in Alberta. So that's another issue. Canada deals with a lot of indigenous issues, not only in countries like Guatemala, but here in Canada. So Amnesty works on issues like this No More Stolen Sisters campaign. They had actually released a report on it 10 years ago that was really kind of starting more of the awareness around that issue. There's also information about the Northern Gateway pipeline debate and the right to water. But the case of the Lubicon Cree was a pivotal case as well, and still is. In 1990, the UN Human Rights Committee ruled that Canada had violated the rights of the Lubicon Cree for the devastation of the Lubicon economy and the way of life. So that was the first Indigenous issue that AI Canada worked on, and it's the first time that Amnesty anywhere in the world took a position on land rights. So before large-scale oil and gas development began, the Lubicon Cree lived a very traditional lifestyle, fishing and hunting, and more so a self-sustainable community. However, since then, the actions of the Canadian and the Albertan government have made these activities almost impossible. Before large-scale oil and gas development began, it was very different from today, where over the last three decades, the province of Alberta has licensed more than 2,600 oil and gas wells in the traditional territory of the Lubicon Cree. That's more than five wells for every person in that land. And today, more than 70% of Lubicon territory has been leased for future resource development, including oil sands extraction. It's a prime example of a powerful, emblematic example of the failure of governments to respect and uphold the legal rights of Indigenous people in the face of resource development. This community has really been devastated and are enshrined in poverty now and do not have access to clean water and all of those issues that come with it. The Lubicon have never entered into a treaty with the government of Canada, nor have they ever given up any rights to their land or territory. Previous efforts to negotiate an agreement to create a reserve or support the Lubicon Society have been stalled for almost a decade. In the meantime, the failure to recognize the Lubicon lands is an excuse used for excluding the people from the decision making and from a fair portion of the revenue generated. What Amnesty calls for on this case, they're calling on the federal government to engage in genuine good faith negotiations on all outstanding issues in the Lubicon land dispute. However, with all the difficulties that the Lubicon Cree have faced in that context, there is also some leadership issues at the moment. So it's hard to organize because of all the conflicts that have come from the issue of land rights and internal conflicts that have come from that. So pending such a resolution, urgent measures must be taken to prevent further erosion of Lubicon rights and reduce hardship and suffering among the Lubicon people. And no resource development activities should be permitted anywhere in the disputed land except with the clearly expressed free, prior, and informed consent of the Lubicon people. Free, prior, and informed consent is something that I had heard for quite a while with Amnesty, especially with Canadian mining companies and the Open for Justice campaign. I kind of glossed over it. There's an acronym for it, FPIC, and I never really slowed down to think about what that would mean for people, but for it to be expressed freely, so the people have the option and the flexibility and the choice in it, and before the work starts, before the papers have been signed, before the decisions have been made, and informed consent, also waiting that people actually say yes, because sometimes it's all well and good to say, here's what we're thinking about doing, here's how we want to do it, and then somebody says no, and you go ahead and do it anyway, right? And so free, prior, and informed consent, every element of that is so important in these dealings. And then lastly, Amnesty is calling that interim funding should be provided to ensure delivery of essential services, including sanitation and water, in manner satisfactory to the Lubicon people. So access to this is a community that started out self-sufficient and has had that eroded away. So it just makes sense that they need to have access to sanitation and water. So all things considered, so I've kind of given you a gloss over of a lot of different cases and just a taste of what Amnesty is about. And what if you could write to one of these people? What if you could send a birthday card to Omar Khadr? What if you could write to these people and say, hang in there, you'll get there? Or write to the authorities campaigning on their behalf saying, I'm watching, I'm paying attention to this case. You can. We have a Right for Rights event this Wednesday, December 10th, for International Human Rights Day. So when the UDHR came into being, that is the day that's celebrated as International Human Rights Day, and people participated in it all over the world. 1 year for it, I don't know if they're doing it again this year, but in Toronto, the CN Tower was lit up as a yellow candle for International Human Rights Day. Anyway, see, these are some of the cases that we're going to be working on this Wednesday for the write-a-thon. We'll be writing letters on behalf of this fellow here on the bottom right. He's a blogger in Saudi Arabia. He was blogging, and he criticized religious figures. So the charges, he's actually been sentenced now to 10 years in prison, 1,000 lashes, and a fine of 1 million riyals, which is about $290,000 Canadian. And he'll be in a Saudi Arabian prison, or he is. He was sentenced May 7th of 2014. So that is one case we'll be writing on. There's also the Chelsea Manning case on the bottom left here. So Chelsea Manning had that got a lot of coverage in North America. She's a U.S. Army private serving 35-year term in prison for leaking government material to WikiLeaks, and she exposed potential human rights violations by U.S. troops abroad, Afghan and Iraqi forces, and the CIA. So charges such as aiding the enemy were brought against her, and that's why she's serving 35 years of prison. So with this one, Amnesty is saying whistleblowers who reveal info that the public has a right to know need to be protected rather than unfairly charging them. Couple more. In the middle on the bottom there, that is for communities of Bhopal. That's Safreen Khan and Rampyari Bai. Survivors from Bhopal still have not received adequate compensation to cover the full extent of their injuries, and the factory site has been abandoned. It has not been cleaned up since the crisis, and the companies responsible have not been held accountable. So it's follow-up on an older story that still is ruining people's lives in that community today. We also have a letter that's going to be going out for missing and murdered Indigenous women. As I said earlier, Amnesty's been very involved with that campaign for quite some time, and so you can once again write a letter pushing for action on this issue. You can also write a letter of support to different communities. And then there's also a feature that we'll be doing on seven Guatemalan men who were protesting outside of a mine. It was a peaceful protest. However, the security forces there started shooting them with rubber bullets and tear gas. And so some of them have had, one of them was shot in the face, some of them have had a very difficult time coming back from being shot with rubber bullets and the tear gas. So there is now a civil lawsuit through an organization in Vancouver. So the letter on this case is pushing that victims be able to seek justice in Canada for the violations by Canadian companies abroad, as well as to have a mining ombudsperson to receive and investigate complaints. So those are just a few of them. There's actually 10 total that we always work on. And I think we're hoping for about 150 letters to get to leave our hands that night. So it's a great event. Oh, the Oh, I had a great font for that, and it got messed up. Darn. It's December 10th at the Artful Dodger from 5 till 9 p.m. And here's just some other ways to get involved with Amnesty, whether it's going on the website and just familiarizing yourself with some of these issues, getting informed on what interests you and what makes you passionate, or donating to Amnesty. You could become a member or a supporter, or you can join us, Group 91, or any of the other groups here in Saskatchewan. There are a few of us. And receive emails about human rights campaigns, participate in letter writing, come to Write for Rights, any of the above. Or you could sign a petition downstairs. I brought some. So that's pretty much it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Libby. And so now is an opportunity for people to ask you questions or perhaps to make comments. So does anybody have any?
Thank you, Libby. And I've got a, excuse me, I've got a tough one for you.
Okay.
And it's what does Amnesty International intend to do against ISIS? Criminal activity and Al-Qaeda criminal activity and offshoots of Al-Qaeda community. Do you have a campaign, a letter writing? And I know it's a tough one, but I would like to know what they intend to do or what the reason is they never mention anything about, you know what, they don't respect human rights, we should do something about it.
Mm-hmm. I haven't read the full report on ISIS and Al-Qaeda yet, but I think the campaign against torture is what I can speak to in terms of Amnesty's involvement, but because that obviously the campaign against torture, it's very no torture. We need to stop torture completely, because who gets to decide where the decisions of who needs to be tortured and when it becomes truth, what the person's saying who's under that kind of duress, when that's truth and when that isn't. So I'm not sure on the specifics of their action plan with the ISIS situation, though.
So is there a position on Julian Assange and Snowden? I mean, they're not in prison, but they might as well be.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, on specific each one, I learn as I go. I can't really recite the each one of the positions that they take.
I think one of the things that really concerns me recently in the last 5 or 10 years is the number of journalists around the world who are being imprisoned and also killed. And, you know, when that happens, it means that the whole world, we don't get the news, we don't get the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, there are the three journalists who were reporters for Al Jazeera who are in prison in Egypt. And then, you know, in the Middle East, many of the reporters have been captured and tortured or murdered. So do you have any kind of special thing for journalists, or is that they are just included with everyone else?
Journalists, issues for journalists, they have come through in urgent actions when specific journalists have been taken or disappeared or anything like that. Those come out in urgent actions, and then we write on their behalf. Yeah.
Thanks. Hi. I just wanted to say what wonderful work Amnesty does. And, you know, I follow it, but when you're involved in so many things, it's just too hard. But I was going to ask about Snowden too, but of course you're not going to know about all of the cases because there are so many. And daily, I mean, that's a horrible reflection of the bad side of humanity, right?
Yeah.
It's a reflection of how much abuse is going on in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have the terrorism that was perpetrated against the women in Montreal that we've been remembering this week.
Yeah, probably.
So there are so many issues. And the kind of abuse that happens to women every day in this society.
Mm-hmm. But that's what I can't profess to know everything about all of Amnesty's stances, but I like that. Every time I do something with the Amnesty group or like doing a presentation today, it gets me to learn a little bit more. It just pushes you to get onto the information side of things, get yourself informed.
This will be our last one.
I just need to know more about when you join a letter writing campaign. Give me an example outside of Canada of where these letters would go.
Oh, okay.
To whom are they addressed, for example, in any kind of international setting? And my question, of course, arises from what Bruno said about ISIS. Like, I mean, who in ISIS are you going to write to and say, now you stop what you're doing?
Yeah.
So can you give me some examples of who you write to?
So every letter that we have on the second or at the end of the call to action there, it has the name, address, sometimes Twitter, sometimes email as well. It can be the Minister of Justice sometimes, like in cases with Mexico, I've seen that. It can be different ambassadors, but oftentimes it's the leader of the country as well. And so what they do is they have it, please address your email or your letter to this person, this person, this person. And then some of them will have copies to these people as well. So, but Amnesty does, they will get the president's address. They will get, there was one case writing to North Korea. We couldn't write to North Korea, so we had to send it to the ambassador in New York. But otherwise, it is the world leaders, the leaders of those countries a lot of the time. And if it specifically is dealing with legal issues, then I'll often see like a Minister of Justice on it. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.